Okay. Afraid to say anything after that. All right, I think for the moment anyhow, we're good to go. It's okay, I'm still getting a little feedback. Okay. As I was saying, I've been intrigued by broken things for as long as I can remember. Buildings in ruins, silhouetted against the sky. Broken seashells on the beach. Tree snags. That's where my eyes go first. We were in a small boat in the Blue Cypress Marsh in Florida in February at one point, surrounded by all sorts of plants and birds and a fair complement of alligators. And I'll tell you, I saw every tree snag in that marsh. I did get around to looking at the other stuff too, seriously, but I saw every tree snag in that marsh because that's where my eyes go. I'm not sure why. I think perhaps though it's because for many, many years I felt that I too was a broken thing. In retrospect, I think I felt a real kinship with ruined buildings and broken shells, and that connection sustained me. I wasn't alone. But perhaps, too, it's because their brokenness allows us to see into them and to see through them. Their brokenness opens onto vistas beyond them, inviting us to see with greater depth. As I wrote in my April Unigram column, we tend to assume that wholeness is a good thing. It seems better than whatever alternatives we might propose. Fragmentation? Brokenness? Yeah, to be whole seems in kind of a self-evident way very much better. But does it work? Does it square up with reality? My sense of myself and of life itself as broken is also what drew me to Buddhism initially. As many of you know, one of the summaries of the Buddhist teaching is the Four Noble Truths. They're truths forged in the experience of those who show up for life, those who take the risk of being fully present. Buddhism doesn't blink in the glare of life's harsher realities. Life is suffering, the Buddha is reported to have said bluntly in his initial address to his followers. Now, nowhere was it said that life is only suffering and dismay, so let's get rid of that old thing to start with, because that's an oftentimes misinterpreted. But if we're alive, and if we're awake to all of life's realities, we'll encounter suffering. That's the first noble truth. The Buddha emphasized suffering, though, for a very specific reason. He wasn't just trying to be a wet blanket. He was convinced that we could limit suffering for ourselves and for other beings, and eventually transcend it altogether. In order to do that, though, we must accept that's how life is, and understand why it is that way. And the second truth answers that why question. The Buddha said that our suffering was caused by clinging, craving, desire, words, you know, a word that gets translated variously like that, though. But the word connotes a very specific kind of desire. It's the desire for private fulfillment. It consists, as Houston Smith puts it so well, not of all inclinations, but of those that pull against life as a whole. As so often is the case when I read Houston Smith, his turn of phrase is about perfect. Not of all inclinations, but of those that pull against life as a whole. Suffering occurs, in other words, when we seek our own fulfillment without regard for the whole and apart from everything else. Which usually means, by the way, at the expense of everything else. Example of that that seems to be very much in the forefront right now. We seek the convenience of single-use plastics, and they end up, almost unfathomable amounts of them end up in our oceans and littering our beaches, and they end up in the bellies of the creatures that live in the ocean. So just because it's convenient for us does not mean that it works for everybody. So these troublesome desires, these ways of seeking our own fulfillment apart from everything else, Buddhists have identified three of these, typically. Pleasure, material goods, and immortality. All of which, by their very nature, cannot be satisfied. Well, most UUs, I think, don't fall into these three traps, at least not in their more blatant forms. Sometimes, yes, but generally not, maybe. We may, however, as do a lot of people, grasp at something that we label as wholeness. Buddhism speaks directly to our desire for wholeness as well, for a wholeness which, like the more traditional hungers, because of the way we frequently come at it, we cannot fulfill, because it cannot be fulfilled. Well, the third noble truth then draws the logical conclusion from the first two. There's suffering, it has a cause, in order to transcend and, or at least lessen suffering, not only for ourselves, but for all beings, we need to rein in our hunger for isolated individual fulfillment at the expense of other beings. Now, Buddhists outline a traditional path for doing this in the form of the Eightfold Path, and that's not real relevant to what I want to talk about, so let's leave that out. But there is another very short, pithy summary of the Buddhist teachings that's called the Three Marks of Reality that are relevant. The first simply restates the first noble truth. Life is marked by suffering. Even those of us who have good lives by any reasonable standard, if we haven't encountered suffering, we will. If we claim we haven't, or that we will not, we're simply deluding ourselves. It will happen. Well, the second and third of these marks of reality go beyond this one and add quite a bit to our understanding. The second characteristic of reality, all of reality, is that everything changes. Very simple, everything changes. Nothing is what it was the moment before. Life is just a constant state of flux. Every living thing is in a constant state of flux. Even things we think of as non-living. Granite mountains, for example, change so slowly that the change is usually imperceptible. But they do change, and they keep changing. You hold a rock in your hand, it doesn't look like it changes. But even at that moment, that rock is changing. Very, very slowly, but it is changing. The Buddha then took this statement about reality in general and applied it specifically to us. We change, too, continually. The idea that there is no eternal self, there is nothing that underlies all the change, was quite radical in the time and place in which the Buddha lived, because people generally believed that there was an eternal, unchanging reality. And it was both kind of out there and in here. And that idea was a backbone of Indian culture. That eternal reality lives on from reincarnation to reincarnation, but what's really real is that unchanging reality. The Buddha said, that's not the way it works. There's not an eternal unchanging reality. There is just the changing, continually flowing interconnectedness of all of life. When we get caught in the idea that we're separate from everything else, it leads to a restricted sense of self. That self may be individual and isolated, or it may be inflated and aggrandized, but it's restricted nevertheless. There is, in other words, no immutable essence that underlies existence. No really real underneath it all. The really real is our constantly flowing, constantly changing experience. The Buddha described the self as dependent on everything that's gone before and constantly changing in response to the constantly changing reality of which we're all a part. So what does this suggest about our passion for wholeness and for attaining it? Well, first of all, it seems to me wholeness is always changing. When we think of wholeness as a fixed end point, a something that once we attain it, we have it, we've already lost it. Once we think we've attained it, we've already lost it, because it's not a fixed thing that we can grab onto. At that point, we set ourselves up for suffering because we're asking reality to be other than it is, and reality does not deal kindly with that request. It's not going to change to fit our thoughts about what it should be. Whatever wholeness we find, then, we have to find it in the midst of change. Change, after all, is all there is, so how could it be otherwise? Which leads to another thought. Wholeness and incompleteness are not at all incompatible. Maybe our situation is not the dichotomy of wholeness versus brokenness, the way it's frequently put. Rather, it's a paradox of simultaneous wholeness and incompleteness. Wholeness and being in process. Being not whole is not the same as being broken. Unlike the cake that we put in the oven, we're never done. We're always half-baked. Sometimes some of us more than others. A third insight that I take from Buddhist teaching is that we attain wholeness only in community. We find our own wholeness in community, and only as our communities find wholeness together. That goes for the world, our nation, our city, our congregation, our families, and indeed the entire ecosystem. We are not and cannot be whole apart from others. As I mentioned during Joys and Sorrows, today marks the starting date 25 years ago of the devastating Rwandan genocide. Thousands, the country's Hutu ethnic majority, unleashed unspeakable violence against the Tutsi minority and against moderate Hutus who refused to participate in the killing. In just 100 days, nearly 1 million people were killed. I'm going to talk about one response that Rwanda has made to as a nation to this. They've embarked on a very carefully orchestrated program of reconciliation. And part of that's a monthly day of service known as Umuganda. And the whole premise behind this thing is very simple, and it's been extraordinary in how they've reinforced it. Every able-bodied Rwandan citizen between the ages of 18 and 65 must take part in community service between the ages of 18 and from the ages of 18 and 65. 3 hours a month. It's not a huge thing, but 3 hours a month. The community identifies a new public works problem to tackle each month. This compulsory work is emblematic of a much broader culture that the government has put in place. Involving development and also involving some very strict social control. And that makes it, I think, kind of difficult to see kind of what's going on here sometimes. But for example, one of the things that came out in a recent interview that I saw was Rwandans are required by law to simply refer to themselves as Rwandans, not Hutus, not Tutsis, but Rwandans. I expect a lot of us would have some trouble with that. I think the way to bring about unity is not to expunge difference. It's not to try to cook it all down into a stew where you can no longer tell the carrots from the potatoes from the peas, but to do something much more finely nuanced. But anyhow, that's how they did it. That makes it difficult to gauge how people really feel about it, because if they don't feel good about it, they don't talk about it. Interestingly, the bureaucracy gone nuts. The government's National Unity and Reconciliation Commission, yes, they actually do have something by that name, has twice released a reconciliation barometer, which looks at dozens of factors to determine how well people are living together. Last year that the figures were available was 2015, and the government said that reconciliation in Rwanda was at 92.5%. That makes it interesting. Certainly the evolving nature of wholeness means that we won't get it right all the time. We will make mistakes. We will make each other angry. We will hurt each other. We will miss good opportunities and embrace things that turn out to have been very bad opportunities. There's always room for forgiveness for one another and for ourselves. There's always room to step back, regroup, begin again. I want to talk about Fort Wayne Mayor and presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg, too, who recently apologized for using the phrase "all lives matter" in a speech that he made in 2015. The context, what he had said, was that there isn't a contradiction between respecting the risks that police officers take and recognizing that we absolutely must overcome biases that are just built into a criminal justice system that treats people from different backgrounds differently. He was trying to hold that balance and stepped into a snake pit in the process. He acknowledged that since learning how all lives matter has been used to push back against activism and has become used as a kind of an anti-slogan to the Black Lives Matter movement, he's intentionally stopped using the phrase. Another example of this not getting it right all the time is the language of some of our hymns. I was struck by one we sang last Sunday, "Guide My Feet," which I like, and it's a very, very singable tune. "Guide my feet while I run this race," repeated several times, and then "guide my feet while I run this race so I will not run this race in vain," or something to that effect. That's language that many people may experience as ableist, assuming that we can all indeed run this race. Another example along the same lines, Jason Shelton, who wrote "Standing on the Side of Love" and then subsequently changed it to "Answering the Call of Love" after concerns raised at General Assembly. We don't intend to exclude, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I'm not personally one to immediately take an eraser or a pair of scissors to the traditional language and hymns. But I get the problem. I do get the problem. We're dealing with a similar issue with pronouns we use. As our understanding of gender expression broadens, our commitments to inclusion call for new language. And yeah, we're going to mess up. It's going to be awkward for a while, but it's also necessary. During this sabbatical time, we've embarked upon several activities to grow our own wholeness as a church community. And some of these have been more successful than others, and each of us probably kind of has our own list about which ones have worked and which ones haven't. There are more to come. Our lurching toward wholeness as a church mirrors struggles toward wholeness at every level, from the entire ecosystem to our own hearts. We had some stormy days while we were on the Florida coast this year, with winds that prompted the posting of beach hazard warnings for rough surf and dangerous rip currents. Those warnings always include advice to swim only where there's a lifeguard and not to swim solo. Analogously, in order to be and become whole, we need community. We need the safety of others. We need people in whose eyes we see our best selves reflected back, and we need to be that reflection for other people. We need others to pick us up when we falter, and we need to be there to pick other people up. We need mutual and caring accountability. We need others who can celebrate our joys and sustain us in tough times. We need communities that encourage and support our engagement in fostering the wholeness of the web of life itself. We weave wholeness or we perpetuate the lack of it together. Buddhist understanding of the nature of selfhood is that wholeness mandates self-inclusion. It just doesn't happen otherwise. Inclusion of all parts of ourselves, commitment to radical inclusion in our culture, commitment to the inclusion of all beings and the planet itself within the scope of our care and our concern. Also calls us to recognize that the reality of wholeness is constantly changing. It is our lived moment-by-moment experience, not a concept. When we try to capture it in a concept or in a method, and goodness knows there are methods aplenty out there, but when we try to capture it in a method, we lose it. It requires of us more our cooperation than our direction. May we become whole together. Closing hymn is, O life that maketh all things new. Ringing affirmation of the always present possibility of newness